Across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
On FM, digital and your mobile.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Delicious.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. Our thanks to Ollie Slack for the last hour. Football is back already. Now let's get our mandibles around some edibles. The Flavour team is Alan Alder, Sue Bailey and me, Matt Bentman.
And on today's programme, onions and what to do with them. We've suggestions from local chefs Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern and Rosie Sykes.
And I just roasted them with some cider, sage, a tiny bit of stock and some olive oil or butter.
Rick Stein's Road to Mexico is being repeated on BBC Two at the moment. We enjoyed his long weekend series as well, so much so we chatted to him about it.
I went for the intestines, not so much the spleen, a bit sort of greasy and slightly, obviously smelling a little awfully, but not a smell that I was used to. I can put up with pig's intestines, but not necessarily cow's spleen.
And we cover new Cambridge eating places pretty extensively here on Flavour, but let's not forget the best of the rest. There's a very good Carolan restaurant in Newnham Road called the Rice Boat, for example.
There was one lady who was the most prominent cookbook writer in Kerala. I believe her granddaughter once came here, and at that time we used to have this customer diary where they could put down comments, and she wrote down saying, "This is food that my grandmother would have cooked, and as good as that." So that's one of my most prized comments.
We also have a trip to Cambridge's Goat Farm and Andrew Webb on a 1924 guide to London restaurants.
By Diner Out, that's his nom de plume.
And you can email us at any time on flavour@cambridge105.co.uk or send a tweet to @flavour105.
Now, one of the Cambridge restaurants I've enjoyed eating in a lot over the years is Rice Boat in Newnham Road, and the food is always good. Its cuisine is that of the southwestern Indian state of Kerala and is pretty distinctive. Don't expect chicken tikka masala. I spoke with Rita and Jacob about Kerala's food and people's reaction to it, and during the conversation, I discovered something extraordinary about Cobra beer.
When people come here, having not been to a Kerala restaurant before, what's their reaction to the food? Are they
surprised by it?
Is it different, substantially different from what they've had before?
Yeah, it's the taste is what they're blown away by. So much lighter is what I get a lot, and fresh tasting. So, and from the Indian customers, it's like my mother would make at home. You know, it's the feeling that it's made in somebody's home kitchen as opposed to, a business. But for the people who've not had Kerala food, the menu always puzzles them a bit because they're not seeing any familiar jalfrezis and madrases. So that, as long as you handhold them through that initial order, but the taste is what they're blown away by, how fresh tasting it is. Mm. And that mix of spices and the coconut milk, just adds that slight bit of richness. This is another factor.
There was one lady who was the most prominent cookbook writer in Kerala. And she took it upon herself to educate the local housewives on how to cook and home economics and everything else. I believe her granddaughter once came here, and at that time we used to have this customer diary where they could put down comments, and she wrote down saying, "This is food that my grandmother would have cooked, and as good as that." So that's one of my most prized comments. We often have visitors coming to Cambridge, and these are children who live in Cambridge and their parents or relatives have come, and after a while they want to have some Indian food and they bring them here. And you can see the pleasure on the visiting parents' faces when they're eating something very, very close to home-cooked food. So, yes, what we are doing is relevant, it is authentic, and it does strike a note with people who are visiting from India, which means a lot. And that is something that we try very hard to do. A lot of vegetarian stuff, a lot of seafood. So you have Christians, you have Muslims, you have Hindus. So there's vegetarian, non-vegetarian, a mix of a lot of different types of cuisine.
There's a dish here called Syrian Christian stew, which sounds slightly worrying.
We believe St. Thomas, one of the apostles, came to the coast of Kerala in AD 52, and he converted some families into Christianity. And at that time, the head of the church was based in Syria. And the Syrian Christian stew is a celebratory dish that we have at Christmas or on festive occasions, which we eat with an appam, and that is where the name comes from.
Now, when I've eaten this dish, which is one of my favourites, it's always struck me how good the quality of the chicken in it is. I wonder if you could tell me something about what efforts you go to get good quality provisions in the first place, Rita?
Yes, I mean, the chicken actually we buy locally in Cambridge, but the more iconic fish, like the kingfish, we buy from Billingsgate Market in London.
Well, where's kingfish from?
It's fished between the waters between Sri Lanka and India, so on the east coast. Yeah. But we get it all around the waters in India, in southern India. Hence why in Kerala it's the best fish. The fish for the best occasions would be a kingfish. And they're huge. I mean, each piece that I buy is about 18, 20 kilos, a single fish. And we bring it back fresh and it's filleted to go into the curries. It's sometimes a bit tricky getting the fish, but it's beautiful fish. It's really very meaty fish, so it's really good in curries. It stays together, the shape is there, and it's a bit like swordfish, would you say? It's in terms of the flesh, but it's one of our best fishes, and hence the only fish we serve.
Yes, and so you go to Billingsgate for it. Yeah. So do you travel widely to get good ingredients?
Yes, I mean, it's crack of dawn. You know, I'm up at 4:30 and I leave at 5:30. To do the shopping run, which also then extends to the East End of London for the pulses and the lentils and the vegetables from New Spitalfields Market in Leytonstone. So it's usually the fish market first, then Spitalfields, and then the East End for the spices. And the lentils.
Right.
And,
why did you go to London for spices? I mean, you can buy spices in Cambridge.
Yes, I mean, with Cambridge, you'd be paying retail price for it, and you don't get the exact brand that we want. We want the Southern Indian brands, which are not, easily found in Cambridge. So we go to the bigger retailers.
So and you want that brand, presumably, because you like the quality of it.
Yes, indeed. And it's
quality
it's,
and
the flavour, yeah.
Customers are very very finely tuned to the level of spiciness and a particular taste. If you change brands, customers do notice.
Because suddenly it's more fiery, and you think, suddenly your fish curry is more fiery than normal, and that's because the Kashmiri chili powder we use. I probably couldn't source the one we normally have, and I've switched brands, and it's people sense it straight away, and so it's important. And also we go to some very small shops in the East End as well for small peculiar items that are specially brought in from Kerala, like the fish tamarind, which goes into the red fish curry. It's like a claw, like looks like a piece of black charcoal, like tamarind, and that imparts a really smokiness to the curry, which just makes that curry very distinctive. And that you have to go to a specialist small shop there in East Ham for me to source that. So it's an all day trip. I leave at 5:30 and I'm back at about 4:30.
And what's particularly popular, Jacob, on the menu?
The iconic thing on the menu is red fish curry. And that is the same for people who come from Kerala, plus all of our regular customers. And one thing I'd like to mention is we have quite a lot of people who come back very frequently. So about 70-80% of our customers are repeat customers, regular customers, long-standing customers.
And another thing that I've noticed on the menu is the beers. Now, you have Cobra beer, which is pretty ubiquitous,
yes.
I think. But you also have some much more craft beers, really.
Yes,
so why is that? I mean, that you must have had to search them out.
We had a choice of going the normal Indian restaurant route, which is to have beer in barrels, you know, draft beer. But draft beer would limit you to, at best, one brand or maybe one or two different barrels. So we chose right at the beginning not to do that and instead to go with craft beers. We have all of our beers and much of our, all of our wine supplied by Bacchanalia. And we have worked in partnership with them now for close to 15 years. And we always have a very, very good range of popular, new, exciting beers. So we're partly guided by them, but they also work on the requirement that I have, which I have a certain preference for the sort of beers I would like to drink with the food that I make. So somebody has to make a choice, and I've said, look, this is the sort of beer I would like to have. And then they come up, and every year they review the list and say, look, we have these new beers now. We now have Calvalese Microbrewery in Cambridge, and that is going down extremely well. So that flexibility to have something new and exciting the moment it appears and to include that in the beer list is very important. One surprising thing about the beers is quite a lot of the beers that we have now are surprisingly American. America is producing some excellent microbrewery beer.
And also Bacchanalia takes it upon themselves to go to the shows every year.
And so
they go, you know, and try new things. Mm-hmm. So we in return benefit from that.
Yeah, but Bacchanalia gives us excellent service and we have fantastic range of the beers and the wines from them. Going back to Cobra, we didn't initially have any of the mainstream Indian Cobra Kingfisher beers. But customers asked for Indian beers.
Yes.
And
it sort of goes with it sometimes with the experience they come to have. Yeah. They're having a curry and they feel they need to have it.
That's the proper thing to have, yes.
Plus we know Lord Billy Moria,
the founder of Cobra.
So yes, shouldn't make that much
and
difference.
In a way we're supporting a local Cambridge boy who started Cobra.
Oh really?
Yes, he was studying here at Cambridge.
Lord Billy Moria came here as a student in Cambridge and he found that many of the Indian restaurants didn't have proper beer that would go well with Indian food. So whilst he was a student, he started sort of researching this and eventually established Cobra.
And he used to go around in his car delivering to all the Bangladeshi restaurants in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And he's the entrepreneur in residence at the Judge as well.
Judge Business School, yeah.
So he does come to Cambridge still and his eldest boy just graduated.
Yeah, that's nice. That's a nice local story. Right, finally, well, two final questions. How long have you been here and what are your opening hours?
We opened in December 2005. We're open 6 days a week, Monday to Saturday. So we open for lunch only on Friday and Saturday because we have weekend visitors coming into the city. But dinner we are open Monday to Saturday, 6 days a week.
Right.
And 6 to 10:30.
Right, okay.
Rice Boat is in Newnham Road. Another good point about Carolan food is that it's more rice-based than North Indian food is. There's less reliance on wheat. So many of the breads they make, for example, their excellent dosas, are made using flour that's not wheat, rice and lentil flour, for instance. So they're gluten-free. And isn't that amazing about Cobra beer?
Oh, yeah, Lord Billy Muria. I hadn't heard of him before. That's grand.
That's extraordinary.
What a way to get started as well.
Isn't it just? Oh, and the food. I love the food there. It's really brilliant. The doses are excellent.
Recommend.
Mm. Yeah. Really nice to hear about Calvary supplying them too, and Bacchanalia, you know, everybody working together.
Jolly good. Now onions and the help of Susan Christie and her song I Love Onions. And she's followed by the words of Flavour's Liz Budd, then Cambridge chefs Rosie Sykes and Tristan Welch.
I don't like snails or toads or frogs or strange things living under logs, but I love onions.
Onions are part of the group of plants called alliums, many of which are poisonous to cats and dogs. Other members of this group include garlic, leeks and chives. Hugh Fernley Whittingstall says that while onions are most frequently used as a foundation flavouring in stocks, stews and sauces, they can also be roasted as their natural sugars caramelise deliciously. Onions can take at least an hour of slow cooking in a covered pan, and longer if they're part of a soup or stew. If you keep the heat gentle, they become sweet, complex, and delicious. However, care is needed, and he goes on to say, the one thing you must guard against is burning. These vegetables can blacken quickly because of their sugar content, and as soon as the caramelization goes too far, from golden brown to almost black, the results are bitter.
I just got some new seasoned onions, which were absolutely beautiful. They still had their long green tails on. And I just roasted them in the oven with some cider, some sage, and a tiny bit of stock and some olive oil or butter. Just cooked them really, really slowly, and they become beautifully caramelized. And then there are so many things you can do with them. You could put them on a tart with some anchovy. You just put them on toast with some lovely cheese. They just they become very rich and special. But the other really nice thing to do, which I do more often with red onions, is slice them quite thickly and then marinate them in lemon juice and salt, and they'll go really vibrant pink. And slice them as a whole round and try and keep them as whole as you can, and then put them onto a griddle pan or the barbecue. Absolutely lovely on the barbecue. And then they are really lovely in a salad with some tomatoes or some griddle courgette, or they make a really nice accompaniment to many, many things.
I don't like shoes that pinch your toes or people who squirt you with a garden hose, but I love onions.
Onions, my nemesis, but actually the building block of so many great recipes. Well, do you know, one of my really, really favourite things with an onion is just to finely slice it, caramelise it in a frying pan, and that's by adding a touch of olive oil in a hot pan, add the onions to it, pinch of salt straight away, and then if you've got any thyme or any hard herbs, pop them in now, and then lower the heat in the pan and gently caramelise them away. And that requires a bit of patience. Let it take half an hour, 45 minutes to caramelise at least. And when you're happy with the caramelisation of it, if they start to caramelise a little bit too much on the bottom of the pan, add a touch of water in the beginning, but towards the end of it, add a splash of vinegar, because that just really lifts it all up. It's quite delicious. Then if you take those caramelised onions, you spread it on some puff pastry. And you know what? Yeah, okay, we make puff pastry here in the restaurant, but at home, we just roll out some pre-rolled puff pastry, spread it with caramelised onions, bake it in the oven. My goodness. And do you know what my boys really like, actually, is some brie broken on top so it just melts on top. Caramelised onion tart within probably about 45, 50 minutes. However, minimal effort. You can have at least half a bottle of wine in that time as well.
And if you grow your own onions and have just harvested them, you might have found that they've perhaps gone rotten, possibly caused by the allium leaf miner. Now, if so, don't miss Dave Fox on the subject later on in today's edition of Flavour.
But if you have a glut, there are some very nice ideas there. Even if you don't grow your own, onions are fantastically cheap.
Mm, and that idea of them on puff pastry just sounds wonderful to
Doesn't
me.
Doesn't it just? Yum.
Here's news of free food available now, Saturday, in Cambridge, and you can find this on the Olio app. If you're listening to a repeat of the programme or to the podcast, check the Olio app for what's currently available. The app is free to download.
Yeah, so having a look today at what is available, Sarah
She's on Trumpington High Street. She has a box of ice cream cones and some whole milk to give away to anyone who's interested. Now, that's available to pick up any time. Yi on Barton Road has some extra virgin olive oil, so that can be picked up during the weekdays after 8 p.m. And finally, this is a new one as well, Food Cycle. They're taking advantage of advertising on Olio. They're offering a free two-course vegetarian meal made from surplus food. This will be at Barnwell Baptist Church. Now, this is an offer that's open to everybody. You'll also get free tea and coffee, good conversation, and guaranteed a lot of smiles. That's on the 7th of August and also on the 21st of August. And Barnwell Baptist Church, for anyone who doesn't know, that's up near Ditton Meadows by the river.
And a reminder that several Cambridge area food outlets sell any unsold goods they have shortly before they close using the Too Good to Miss app, which is also free to download.
Well, you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio, and we broadcast live from the centre of Cambridge on alternate Saturdays from 1 till 2 p.m. Also, we are repeated the following day from 2 till 3, and during August from 1 till 2 p.m. on alternate Tuesdays. We're also available to download from the Cambridge 105 Radio website, from iTunes and plenty of other podcast providers.
Coming up in a few minutes, Rick Stein and Andrew Webb at his historic bookshelf. But first, goats.
Yeah, according to meatgoatblog.com, which we all read, almost 3/4 of the world's population eat goat meat. Now, this makes the UK something of an anomaly because, as you know, we favour beef, pork, lamb, chicken. However, over the last few decades, America has caught on to goat farming. And this is thanks in part to the introduction of the hardy Boer goat breed.
And Boers are proliferating here too, in Cambridge, as it happens. In response, Matt went to visit a local goat farm with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
It's more of a way of life. You're never going to be a millionaire raising goats, you know, but I think they're lovely animals. So long as you're not too uncomfortable about it, they're also very tasty.
Goat meat is featuring a lot in the media these days. It's one of the big food trends of the year. Barbecued goat meat featured on BBC's Countryfile last month. It was also on Celebrity MasterChef, Come Dine With Me. And it's finding its way into many top restaurants. And it's favoured because it braises fantastically, it grills like a joy, and it roasts splendidly. Now, these are the words of Fergus Henderson from St John's Restaurant in Spitalfields, London. Today, I'm in a field in Cambridge on a licensed goat farm, talking with Melanie Onora and her husband John, and their friend Sarah. And Melanie, how big is the herd that you have here?
In total, we've got nearly 50 goats, and 25 of them or so are kids, and the rest are the breeding herd. My grandparents farmed back in Norfolk. They had sheep and pigs, geese, arable farming. Mm. But yeah, this is my first proper experience farming.
All right. Give me a show of hands. How many of you consider yourself commercial goat producers, or that's where your interest lies?
I was in.
You're right.
Big idea.
Goat meat is. I think traditionally we've had a strong liking for. We had to go into London to get goat meat. So we opted to get a small holding. I said, let's give it a try and have a few goats, see what it looks like. This was 7 years ago, and here we are now. So far, so good. The children have been helpful too.
Yeah, really.
How would I say the level of help?
Yeah, our daughter's been really brilliant. She's very good. Good at giving injections, hoof trimming, castrating, birthing.
Hands-on.
Hands-on.
Yeah. Yes.
Castrating and hoof trimming isn't easy. I have trouble.
No. No, they don't offer themselves.
When this all started and went online, we just couldn't keep up with the demand for fresh goat meat. But it is there, it is there. A lot of people travelling overseas and want to come back home and try out their experiences in, you know, North Africa and Caribbean. Where I come from, Nigeria, lamb is a more high-profile meat. Goat is more of a traditional staple meat. Much easier, much hardier animals.
Now, a goat farm is not like a sheep farm or a cow farm. Goats are much more inquisitive, they're very athletic, they're quite mischievous. They need a level of entertainment, of interest, much like a sheepdog does.
I would say that they're pretty smart, yeah. They like to run, jump, play, climb things, get into trouble. They like a routine. They do know that when I turn up at the gate, food is coming.
I think it's probably based on the size of their stomachs. If they've been very well fed and they see you passing by, they'll just have a little wave. But if it's food time and their bellies are empty, then they go for it. You know, so.
I think mine know the sound of my car.
Okay, they
know the sound of my car, and as soon as they hear that, they come up.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I come up in a different car, I don't see them, and then suddenly they're like, oh, you're here.
Oh,
surprise.
<okay.
laughs> So, no, they're very intelligent, I think.
This breed is the...
Boar.
The boar.
Yes, they really are the meat breed because they are much stockier and are going to produce more meat than a dairy goat would.
If there's only one thing that you take away from here, I'd like for it to be this. The most important aspect of meat goat production is reproductive efficiency. It's going to affect your bottom line more than any other possible thing.
So normally when goats have a kid in the first year of doing, they normally only have one, just a singleton baby.
Okay.
And then subsequent years they have twins and triplets. And that's what we've been experiencing on our farm until about 6 or 7 days ago.
Yeah.
One of the first-time mums had quads. I think she was in shock. I was in shock. I phoned my neighbour and said, oh, please, could you come over and help? I can't carry four kids and look after the mum, take them all into the kitchen shed together. So, yeah, we've had a really fabulous week looking after quads.
And this is her, one of the quads asleep on your arm here.
Yes, I think she's looking pretty happy and quite comfortable. Full tummy. Oh, gosh, and even a little smile.
It's the sound of two very hungry baby goats at feeding time. It may not be obvious, but there's a little bit of an art to this, isn't there? Because you hold the bottle at a certain angle so that the air bubbles don't travel through and make the baby burp too much.
Windy, yes.
You have to hold the bottle almost upright because it has to represent the udder.
Okay, well done.
She does.
So it's been covered a lot in the media about how goat meat is gaining popularity, and I just wondered how you're gauging it yourselves. You know, is the market changing?
Yeah, I think we can see quite a big increase in demand. People are much more interested in eating goat meat. Celebrity chefs have been cooking it on television. Lots of people, more people are talking about it. Newspapers, I think, have been giving out, printing recipes that people might enjoy. And like John was saying before, you know, as we're travelling more into kind of Europe, Asia, customers have been telling us, yes, we had goat meat on holiday. Can we buy some of yours? We'd love to, you know, try and cook some up at home. So, yeah, it's becoming much more popular, yeah.
Your goat meat, it's butchered locally, it's sold fresh.
We take the kids to the abattoir at 9 to 12 months and brought back into local butchers into Cambridge where they are hung for 2-3 days as a minimum and then portioned into racks of ribs, some steaks, neck fillets, roasting joints for legs and shoulders.
We also keep some of the liver.
Sometimes we're allowed to keep back the stomachs and the livers. Kidneys and hearts.
Yeah, kidneys and
hearts. Yeah, but that's normally reserved for our private customers because it's really popular. People love it, especially the liver. It's very nice flavour. Mm. Yeah. Really nice.
Now, the other thing is the other products like processed foods. I mean, we'd looked at things like sausages, burgers. There's a gentleman, the butcher's in Cambridge, called Art of Meats. He's done some very beautiful burgers for us. The Art of Meat, I think, is really an artist with meat, isn't it?
Yeah. It's got the correct name for the shop, for the butchers. He's very good at it.
Yeah.
Really good.
There's another gentleman who is doing a lot of work on smokes.
It's dry cured goat legs that he's trying to turn into goat violin meat, which is something that's very popular in Italy.
Yeah.
I think it's called goat violin meat because you hold it like it's a violin, the leg, and when you get the knife and cut it, it's like the bow of a violin.
I see.
I think that's where it comes from. It takes 6 weeks, so yeah.
So we're going a lot more for the processed meat, so really adding value to the meat. Someone called it a niche product. We're not going to do it mass commercial scale, but enough to hopefully satisfy the demand of the clients.
Just to describe the flavour of goat meat in your own words.
Gosh. So I would describe it as kind of a deep, gamey lamb flavour. It's very rich, but once it's treated nicely in the kitchen, you know, tender cooking, it's a really lovely, lovely meat. I wish more people would try it.
And tender is the key word here.
Tender's the key.
The meat from kids It's high in protein and iron, with apparently less than 40% saturated fat than chicken even. I presume that's chicken with the skin on. But the fat has flavour and is full of energy. So this is compensated for when you're cooking goat meat by cooking it slowly, by braising it to retain that flavour, not to reduce it.
Yes, I'll say that's quite right. But the goats that go to the butchers when they're kids still do have a lovely flavour. Mm. Tender, not too fatty, very good for steaks.
There's a waiting list for fresh. People want it fresh. That really is where the flavour is and the future of the business. You know. Maybe at one day, Anglia Farm Shop will be synonymous with good goat meat. That is a hope for the future. Yeah? Yeah? You see the sign of a goat when you hear Anglia Farm Shop.
So John and Melanie Onora and Sarah Chandler, thank you very much. You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Thank you.
It's very nice of you to come. Thank you very much. Yeah?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's Anglia Goat Farms Goat Meats. And they're on Barton Road. They are available at the Art of Meat, as was mentioned, and that's in Arbury Court, as well as the farm's own website, which is angliafarmshop.co.uk. And you can also follow them on Twitter, at Anglia Farm Shop.
John and Melanie are very concerned about the ethical treatment of animals, and their goats are very well looked after. They get plenty of love and affection, shelter and lots of extra food, carrots and parsnips and even blackberries.
And they've got skin like silk, their fur is soft. Anyway, Melanie referenced Story's Guide to Raising Meat Goats. Now, this is a book. This is like a Bible, even. It's by Maggie Sayer. It's it. Don't buy a goat without this book, wrote one reviewer from the Ozarks.
Anglia Farm Shop's website contains recipes for stews, casseroles and goat pie. They also supply ready meals and curry kits. Their home-reared goats eat meadow grass free of herbicides, pesticides, chemicals or fertilisers, and the animals are drug-free.
Yeah, they also want to work with the industry when it comes to saving the billy goats, which, like rams and bullocks, are sometimes dispatched at birth. Now, there's an initiative in Holland where dairy goat farming is a big industry, and billy goats are a sad consequence of that. Well, the initiative is attempting to turn things around by enabling male kids to be reared rather than simply put down at birth. And this strikes more of a balance towards the ethical and commercial rearing of billy goats.
And here on Flavour, we're not only keen on eating food, we'd like to cook it, research its history, read books about it and look at it on television. So when TV chef Rick Stein visited Cambridge a while ago, Alan dashed off to chat with him about his series Long Weekends and asked him how he decides where to eat for his programmes.
Well, I mean, we've got really good research. So, I mean, people that work with me on the book and also on the TV programme, the brief really is that we want to go off the beaten track, and we don't want places that are necessarily comfortable and, you know, easy, because we want places that have got atmosphere. Sometimes it means that, you know, we do find restaurants are a bit sort of scruffy, is a nice way of putting it. Maybe the toilets aren't the sort of most up to date that you've ever seen, but the food's brilliant. And also, it's just, I mean, I'm thinking of somewhere like Lisbon. We found a really nice beer and seafood place in a part of town you wouldn't normally go, because it's a bit. When I say dangerous, you would certainly want to keep your hands in your pockets when you went there.
Well, you talk about atmosphere, and in Palermo, you talk about it being sort of slightly seedy, actually.
Yes.
Do you think that adds to the pleasure of eating?
I certainly think so. In Palermo, it's almost like, you know, only the Italians could create a seedy place with such style. I think it's partly because the centre of Palermo has not been developed for, you know, years and years and years. And I think that was something to do. I'm not a historian, but I think that actually the council put a blank on any development until they could sort out what to do. I think because at the time there was sort of, I think, certain elements in Palermo life, no names, no pack drill, were talking about bulldozing the whole of the centre of Palermo down to build modern blocks, and the council fortunately put a stop on any development, but the result is that there hasn't been the money to develop it, so you walk through streets of decaying palaces, which to a visitor is the most marvellous thing. I always think it's a bit like in Cornwall. We've got this place called the Lost Gardens of Heligan, where this Victorian garden has partly been discovered and done up by Tim Schmidt, who also runs the Eden Project in Cornwall. But it's so nice because there's still bits of garden that are sort of overgrown. And Palermo's like that. It's just got this fabulous atmosphere. And, of course, everybody says, oh, what about the mafia? I mean, you wouldn't know the mafia were there. Yeah. Well, occasionally you get told, you know. There was one restaurant we were actually filming in that had got so fed up with demands for protection money and bonfires being lit in front of their restaurant that they up sticks and moved across town.
You talk in Palermo about how good it is to be in a place where people have got a desire for robust food, and you mentioned spleen and intestines. did you try? You don't say that you tried those.
Oh,
in
yes,
the book.
I did. Right. I did.
What are spleen and intestines like?
I went for the intestines, not so much the spleen, a bit sort of greasy and slightly, obviously smelling a little awfully, but not a smell that I was used to. I can put up with pig's intestines, but not necessarily cow's spleen. There is an awful lot of street food in Palermo, which is utterly delicious, and I sort of think it is, in Europe, one of those, probably the street food place in the whole of Europe. I mean, obviously places like Southeast Asia and India, you've got like fantastic street food, but Palermo is up there with them.
Yeah, something else that you mentioned which is unusual was, I think, in Copenhagen, roast dandelion buds, rather different from spleen, I know, but what are roast dandelion buds like?
Well, actually, they're very nice. but I think the big thing in Copenhagen now is this new Nordic cuisine idea where they only cook local food. So they don't use olive oil, they don't use lemon juice, they'll use vinegar, they'll use dandelions, and they'll use beetroot and horseradish. And there's something quite laudable about that because it is very local food. It's just that I did find when we made the programme in Copenhagen, there's a bit too much sort of placing of little buds and pickled this and that on plates. But, you know, there's a mixture of things that I did like and thought a bit over the top.
You mentioned, I think more than once actually, the importance of locally grown or locally reared food. Is there a danger, as more and more people become foodies and start going to nice restaurants, that the demand is going to exceed the supply? Do you see any signs of that?
Well, yeah. I don't, because, I mean, what's happening, and we've noticed that in our own restaurant business in Padstow, is that, you know, there's one, a few local butchers have risen to the challenge. I mean, the butcher we use in Launceston in Cornwall actually supplies a lot of the restaurants I know in London. And same with our fishmonger, Matthew Stevens, that it's almost like the locals have sort of seen that there's a market, particularly in produce from somewhere like Cornwall, which has got a bit of a sort of, you know, people regard it as being pure and wholesome. But I suppose in terms of, when you're talking about demand, you also mean the supply of really good fish. I don't think that is a problem because most of the good fish and good seafood from the UK goes abroad to Spain and France, and all we're doing is diverting it where it should go with us.
Yeah. A lot of the places that you visit in this book and on the TV are ports, and I'm wondering whether, I mean, that's not solely because you like fish, is it? Because a lot of the dishes aren't fish. So do ports just have an interest for you, or is there better food there?
David Pritchard, the director, and I have a great affection for ports, for being by the sea, and I suppose it's not for no reason, although I hadn't actually thought about it, but you're absolutely right. There's always, I mean, the great thing about having a city on the sea is there's always fishing that you can turn to for a story. And I think in somewhere like Cadiz, it makes the city as well, because it's right on the ocean, on the Atlantic Ocean. It's not like like Lisbon. Again, you think it's on the ocean, but actually it's not. It's up the Tagus River. But Cadiz, the light is superb, just simply because half of what you're seeing is flat ocean. And that it just makes for a very different atmosphere, I think.
One of the unusual
dishes in your book, although not a difficult dish, is seps as a dessert, which to me is an extraordinary idea I've never come across before.
Well, I mean, similarly, I hadn't come across it, but it came from that wonderful restaurant in Bordeaux called La Tupina. And we were there in last October, and they were serving them up as a sweet. And I just thought they were really nice. I mean, nobody's ever thought of it in my experience, and the same as yours. But it worked wonderfully with some fruit and in a sweet dish. They were lovely.
Amongst your favourites in the book, have you got a favourite in the book, would you say?
Well, I've got loads of favourites. I mean, for a very simple dish, there's one from Lisbon, which is, again, it was from this place called Ramiro's, with this beer and seafood house that is basically just clams and prawns fried in olive oil and garlic and chilli, but with loads of coriander added. And I suppose it's just because I know Lisbon's on the Atlantic, but it sort of classes in my mind with Mediterranean sort of cuisine. And it's very unusual to have coriander, whereas most countries use parsley or basil. That was a real special. I just really enjoyed, in from Venice, a dish called Tafelspitz, which is like a boiled beef with vegetables and lots of horseradish and lots of beef marrow. It's a sort of dish with lots of composite parts, and it's a bit like having the Viennese version of a sort of Sunday roast, but in this case it's poached beef but with lots of horseradish.
You've been doing this for a long time, Rick, haven't you, travelling? I mean, even in the 70s and 80s when you used to shut your restaurant over the winter. It's still exciting, is it?
Well, I think there's always new food to find. And I mean, I've never been, for example, to South America. I'd love to travel extensively over China. I just think it's endlessly fascinating the way people cook. And I'm a little bit down on sort of chefs' creations, not always down on them, but what I love is just local food and just seeing how people adapt in eating to the local, whatever they've got, the local flora and fauna, I suppose, is the way of putting it.
And that's why quite a lot of the recipes are quite straightforward then.
Yes. I don't like doing difficult dishes. I think that the difficult dishes are fine in restaurants where you've got lots of chefs and you can do a lot of preparation, and, you know, it doesn't matter how many garnishes you put on there, somebody that will make them for you. But actually, if you're cooking at home, I think it's very important to keep things as simple as possible. As one of my really good friends, an Australian who has a string of delis in Australia, Simon Johnson, said to me once, cooking shouldn't be difficult. And it really shouldn't. It'd be something that you can do while you're talking to your friends.
Yeah, well, it does look very enjoyable in your book. So thanks very much, Rick.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And that was Rick Stein, who was really good to talk to. His series on Mexico is currently being repeated on BBC Two.
And there's the music signalling time for the latest food tweets from the city. These are today's tweets on Saturday, and you can follow Flavour at Flavour105 to keep up with what we are tweeting.
Yeah, a Bushel Box Farm Shop has tweeted, that's in Station Road, William. They are featuring upside-down plum cake with their own plums and coffee from Hot Numbers. I must say that plum cake does sound divine. Il Molino is back on Cambridge Market tomorrow, Sunday, after visiting the Molino farm in Italy, and he's got a fresh selection of olive oil, and of course their olive oils have won major awards. They also have the most superb jams, and apricot and cherry are my favourites, if you want to know. Roberto's Deli on Cambridge Market today, 10 till 5 and during the week, and also today they're at the Harborough Food and Drink Festival from 11 till 7.
There is a new, well, newish place to eat al fresco in the evenings. It's Limoncello in Mill Road, which has opened up its garden area. Alan went to have a look.
So we've got a lovely Italian bistro in the evening, which is really, really sort of popular, and we've opened up our garden, and although the summer's been
pretty
up and down.
Yes, it's
yeah. And you're doing what? You're doing. I know you're doing pizzas. What else are you doing in the evening?
In the evening, we're specialising in Italian, obviously, but in particular truffle dishes. Authentic Italian, really healthy, very simple but highly delicious and beautiful things. We've got a lovely chef in from Bari. And another chef and manager who's from a lovely place called Gubbio, which is up in Umbria. And so, yeah, really, really, so you wouldn't necessarily find, other sort of high street chains. Mm.
Yeah. Can I have a quick look at the garden?
Yeah, come on, follow me. Here we go. So this is south facing.
Yes, and we have the benefits of a sunny morning as well.
And it's a bit higgledy-piggledy at the moment, but... Yeah. It's a really lovely. Again, you've got you haven't got the traffic noise at the moment, but yeah. It's generally nice.
Yeah, and it's green, and there's a covered area as well.
It's just like a little oasis, and not many people know about it. It's a bit of a secret, really. So,
And what time are you open until?
At 10:30 at night now.
Well, so. Every night is that?
Well, apart from Sunday, we close at 5. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
And that was Steve Turville from Limoncello on the Romsey side of Mill Road.
Right, now let's go in a time machine from Mill Road 2019 to London 1924 with Andrew Webb at his historical bookshelf.
This week on the historical bookshelf, I have a book from 1924 called London Restaurants by Diner Out. That's his nom de plume. And it's a sort of slim pocket-sized volume, only about a centimetre thick. And it lists his favourite restaurants in London in the 20s. And it's quite extensive. And it's brilliant because most of the restaurants are serving French classical food. And they tend to be in grand hotels. And the food is always in French. It always starts with hors d'oeuvres. And it's always about the wine list and this sort of thing. But there's a few interesting pieces in here. And I like this one, The Spanish Restaurant on Swallow Street. And this is kind of interesting because, you know, he says, oh, you can travel down the stairs and suddenly you are there. I think this is now Corrigan's place. Anyway, so it's really interesting. So he kicks things off with... hors d'oeuvres, as you do, and which is in this case is olives and a glass of sherry. And then it came a Spanish omelette with red peppers, a little onion, potatoes, beans. I think we probably call that a tortilla now. And then he says the great event of the evening, Paella de la Valencia. And when it arrived, I held my breath. It was a symphony of colour and an elaborate arrangement that baffled at first sight. On examination, it proved to be chicken with mussels, lobster, tomatoes, various vegetables and rice. It sounded rather rich and indigestible, but did not prove so. And he drinks Rioja, and, you know, tapas is quite cool now, and we all think, oh, yeah, tapas. They were eating this in the 1920s, these sort of paella dishes and things like that, and drinking Spanish wines. And so I really like that one. He starts the book with a sort of section on sort of good manners, and this I like too. So he talks about being a gourmet, and there's a section here on novelties, and I like this bit. So he says here, I know a few new foods that have been invented or discovered in recent years. The latest is a brand new cheese called Vacherin, which is something like camembert, but with a more pronounced flavour. So that's really nice to think that, now you see Vacherin in the shops, you imagine it's been made since time immemorial by French dairy farmers, but actually, here he is sort of getting it sampled in the 20s, at least in this country. It may be that it's a bit older than that. So as well as all the great hotels in London and the Criterion and the Barclay and all those sorts of big kind of places to go and have lunch, which is pretty much where people went for lunch if you wanted to eat well. He also kind of gets a bit off the beaten track as far as you can go in 1920s. And he goes here to the Chinese Cafe on Oxford Street. And he begins with, the very eminent American novelist had asked us to eat with him. And the little lady of the party elected to go somewhere thrilling and unusual. She loved all adventures, she said, especially adventures in food. Then it had better be the Chinese restaurant, I guess, said the novelist. A chop suey of chicken with tomatoes, bamboo shoot, bean sprouts, onion and beaten egg. Lovely, but remember, no chopsticks. So off he goes to a Chinese restaurant. Then came the menu. Dishes were numbered, 271 of them, with a brief description of most. However, the novelist had lived in the Far East and took matters into his own hands. He advised a dish of steamed egg with pieces of prawn and green peas. It came to the table admirably cooked. But my favourite entry in this book,
and just for the sheer kind of audacity of what he does is this one here. It's the Ivy, of course, which, as we all know, is just in the West End, took down the side street off Cambridge Circus. I was taking two girl cousins to a new play at the Ambassadors, so we decided to have a little dinner at the Ivy, which is not only just opposite the theatre, but has a well-earned reputation for being one of the best restaurants in the West End. In the morning, I telephoned for a table, and also consulted the maitre d'hotel with regard to the menu. I told him that I just wanted a short theatre dinner, and left its choice to him, quite wisely as it turned out. However, I made one stipulation, that we should have sole bonne femme, a particularly delightful dish which I have had several times at this restaurant and always enjoyed. He rings up the Ivy that morning, dictates the menu, and they say, certainly, sir, and off he trots. We drank a little modest bottle of Sauterne, which we diluted with Perrier. As a chaperone of young girls, I am always cautious. And finally, he lists the bill of fare here, and for him and his two cousins, and the little wine diluted with Perrier, total bill is £2.02, which in today's money is about £83. Which is quite a bargain. I doubt you could feed three at the Ivy for 83 quid these days. Brilliant. This has been The Historical Bookshelf. I'm Andrew Webb, and I'll see you next time.
Well, that was another astonishing look back at the past. Thanks, Andrew Webb.
Indeed. Earlier in our feature on onions, we mentioned the allium leaf miner. This is causing a real problem in some areas in the UK, including Cambridge. The pest arrived in 2002 and has spread rapidly. There is no treatment, only prevention. And here's Dave Fox, pleased that his prevention prevented.
One thing about the onions is that we have to cover those throughout March and April in order to keep off the dreaded allium leaf miner, this new pest which is destroying onion and leek crops. And I did that. I had this bed of onions nicely covered, but I wasn't around to remove the cover, so luckily my allotment neighbour Pete, who's an excellent gardener, knew what to do, and he took the netting off, the EnviroMesh off, to let the onions grow nice and tall, and there's a decent crop developing there. Another good spot of rain would be nice to help those bulbs swell up.
And you can tell if your onions are affected because the leaves become rather twisted and may lie on the ground. If it does happen to your crop, you can still eat any unaffected part, but you'll need to put the rest in your green bin. The composting process used for domestic green waste should kill the pest. One method of prevention, as Dave was mentioning, is to use a suitably sized mesh, which will stop the adults getting into your onions and laying eggs. Or you can grow them between the months of May and September, when the naughty little pests are not laying eggs. Good luck.
And there's Green Onion signalling the start of our news section. We begin with jobs.
Midsummer House is looking for a senior member of the waiting team, a chef de rang. It's full-time, but you will work only Wednesday to Saturday. Send your CV to businessmanager@midsummerhouse.co.uk.
The Trinity in Trinity Street wants a full-time commis chef. Phone Cambridge 322 130.
The Rice Boat in Newnham Road urgently needs waiting staff. You can pop in to inquire, or you can phone Cambridge 302 800.
Full and part-time waiting staff are needed at Bennett's in King's Parade. You need to have previous experience and good communication skills. Hand your CV in at the counter.
And if you're applying for any of these positions, good luck. And please say you heard about the job on Flavour here on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Yeah, and if you have a vacancy that you'd like to advertise here on Flavour, you can email sales@cambridge105.co.uk.
Now, on Sunday the 4th of August, from 1 till 4 at Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road, Cambridge, there's a Spanish fiesta with tapas, paella, sangria and cocktails. Three tapas are included in the price, as well as an arrival drink, sangria, and there'll be plenty of other options to indulge in once there. It's £25 per person, and you can book on Cambridge 214 553 or via Eventbrite.
Now, some classes coming up at the Cambridge Cookery and Bistro in Purbeck Street. On the 27th of August, Genuine Gelato for Kids. That's from 10 till 12:30, and it costs £50. On the 28th of August,
Picnic Baking for Kids, which is from 10 till 12 and costs £45. And then on the 28th of August, Italian for Teens, from 1 till 3.30, that's £50, and this course includes making two types of pasta and accompaniments, risotto and anisetti biscuits. And you can book via the Cambridge Cookery website.
Looking further ahead, there is another wine and tapas tasting at the Cambridge Wine Merchants with K. Rico Tapas. The aim of the events is to widen the knowledge of Spanish wines and food. In the first of these, on the 18th of September, the focus is on Spanish grapes, not only how they are in Spanish wines, but how they are used in the wines of other countries. On the 13th of November, however, you can taste what the grapes from other countries are adding to Spanish wines. Book on Cambridge 214 553 or via Eventbrite.
Finally, looking further ahead still, on 14th of September at Cambridge Cookery and Bistro in Purbeck Street off Hills Road, it's Inda's Kitchen. There'll be a plethora of buffet-style dishes in the wine bar from 6.30 onwards. Booking is essential.
And that's all that we have time for today. We are here on alternate Saturdays at 1 p.m, repeated on Sundays at 2 p.m, and in the month of August from 1 till 2 on the Tuesday. And we are also podcast.
And if you'd like to get in touch with any news or comment when we're off the air, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.co.uk or contact us on Twitter at flavour105.
Coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio today at 2 o'clock, Women Making Waves. From 3 till 5, live from the Cambridge Folk Festival. 5 till 6, the Cambridge Football Show. 6 till 8, Chris Brown's Soul and Dance. And 8 until 11, live from the Cambridge Folk Festival. But that's all we've got time for today. We'll be back on the 17th of August. But until then,
goodbye.
Goodbye.